Okay. So thank you again for this opportunity to talk. I thought that last week was a good start, and I also thought that the conversation we had at the end was very interesting.
Professor
So today I was going to continue in some of the directions from last week, and also open up a few other directions, and we can talk about that as it happens and decide which directions to go in.
对，今天我还会继续上一周，延续上一周我跟大家谈的，但是会有从比较不同的面向去讨论。那我也很鼓励大家，如果哪一个面向你们特别有兴趣，就 interrupt me， 然后我们可以讨论这样。
Yeah, I have a number of concepts and points which I could make and I could go over, but I would also be very interested in hearing your feedback. At any point, and stopping to talk about any one of these points in more detail.
虽然这个Professor Case 这个学府约佛啊，但是他也很鼓励大家，你有什么 thoughts 什么 feedback， 就是直接跟他沟通，这样他很欢迎你们喜欢特别哪个部分跟他讨论的就。
Okay, so today I was going to start off by talking about some of the cultural differences which exist. And from my perspective, many of these cultural differences are based on a concept which we are very familiar with here in the United States, because we grow up as a part of our culture, for American individualism.
我知道我们有很多文化差异是是因为有很多不同的因素，但是
American individualism also has a few other phrases or goes by a few other names associated with it. Each one of them indicates something else about this idea of individualism.
这个个人主义还有很多其他不同的名字，不同的 faces like
different
面相。所以我今天也会谈到这些不同的面向跟这些不同的
名词。One of those is rugged individualism. Rugged individualism.
What is that?
Rugged, like tough. Strong.
其中一个就是很呀。
Yeah.
Maybe we don't even
no, maybe not. No.
Right?
And so this is a kind of individualism that is imagined or constructed through overcoming difficulties in one's life.
I was thinking maybe we don't even translation
yeah.
right? Then I can dismiss it. I can just listen.
Yeah.
Even faster.
Even better. Okay. Yes. Sounds good. Okay. Another. But if there's any question at any point about any detail, just. And then I slow down, stop, and go back. It's great. That's great. So another. So one of these kinds of rugged individualism. Individualisms that are attached to the overall idea of American individualism comes from another phrase, the pioneering spirit. And this, the pioneering spirit in the United States is especially referring to a specific moment and a specific time. As I was saying earlier, I was being careful last week to try not to be too negative. And Pastor gave a very positive sermon today, so so I okay. So I can't help today but be a little bit more critical, and it depends on which directions we go, but I may get increasingly critical about some of the histories of the United States, which we should talk about if we're talking about American culture. So the pioneering spirit is this idea of pioneering, obviously, which literally comes from the moment in time when the United States was in formation and when it was still a series of colonies of the European nation states. So that moment in time, as you know, was a very violent, very turbulent moment in time for many different reasons. First off, there's a concept of the frontier. There's an idea of the frontier. And this... Frontier? No? Cool. Okay. Rather than a literal frontier, it's more the idea that a frontier exists. Because, of course, the idea of what existed was more seductive for the people who came from Europe than the actual reality, because the actual reality were that people lived here. And that there, what they had imagined about an unspoiled natural world that they would be exploring for the first time, that expectation was met by the reality that people already lived here and had fully formed cultures, fully formed nations, and not simply one, but many, many, hundreds, in fact. So the idea of the frontier from the European colonists is an imagination. It's an imaginatory idea. But this idea was that there would be a pure, natural place, and we could talk a little bit about what people at that time understood as nature. It might be important to explain a little bit about what they thought nature meant, these Europeans. They had a Western European tradition that made them believe that the natural world consisted mostly of four categories. Raw nature, this is the unspoiled, untouched nature. Subdued nature, this is nature which has been domesticated one way or another. People are natural. And tools that are handmade by people are natural, but machines are not natural, and tools that are made by machines are not natural. Yeah, is that clear? Sure. So raw nature, untouched, unspoiled, pure, subdued nature, nature which has been domesticated, controlled, nature which is under control. Farmland, for instance, is an example. So farmland or pastures where animals are allowed to graze, this is subdued nature. It's been controlled, but it's still natural. So they had these ideas about what constituted the natural world. Right. So when they arrived, they had imagined, at least partially, that they would encounter, for the most part, this concept of raw nature, this concept of unspoiled, beautiful, untouched land. You know, and in some cases, this is outside of my expertise, but in some cases this was also religious in nature. This expectation was religious in nature, that they would find a new world, a promised land. So that's outside my expertise. But they had those ideas. And they had this idea that there was a frontier. In other words, there was a line, and that this line is the frontier. And this line is between basically the raw nature and the people who are arriving. And they had this idea that they would push this line further and further across the physical continent. And again, as I said, when they arrived, they realized that this imagination about an open frontier was in fact complicated by the reality of the First Nations peoples who lived in the United States, or what became the United States. So North America was, obviously, as you know, was populated by what they incorrectly, by cultures that they incorrectly referred to as the Indians. So we no longer use this term Indians to refer to those people who lived in North America. Yeah, so we don't use that term anymore, or we shouldn't. So there was instead of saying Indian, because Indian refers to India, which was the place the Europeans were attempting to go to. So instead of saying Indians, there are a few other terms, at least two other terms. One would be Native Americans. This is a preferred term, Native Americans, because this indicates that those Americans are native to North America, that they were here before the Europeans colonized. That's one term. And that term is also used in Canada. It's officially used in Canada to refer to the peoples who lived in Canada before the Europeans. However, the term that I prefer, and this term has more political implication, is a term which is First Nations. First Nations. So First Nations goes even further than Native Americans and refers to the fact that these were not simply natives, which has a negative connotation. To be a native perhaps means to not be cultured, to not have a culture, right? But to say First Nations indicates that these people had nations and culture and civilization. And in fact, hundreds of them. There were not a few, but many, most of which have been utterly erased from the world. So some have survived, and in different forms. But okay, so hopefully that's clear so far. Okay, so here's where we start to get into some complications. The members of the First Nations peoples encountered this European imperial colonial project of arriving and expanding the colonies. Those colonies then, fought amongst each other, as well as against those peoples that already lived here in North America. And in a, of course, greatly simplified version of this history, they also then formed a singular identity and fought against primarily British control and secured independence from British control to become some idea of a singular country. So to even have a discussion about American culture is to begin to imagine that there is a singular American culture, which is not ever actually true. But let's imagine. The Native Americans, or the First Nations peoples, were also, as part of this British imperial colonial project, primarily because it extended out across the British Empire, not just in the not just in North America, were also the first subjects of compulsory education. They were educated; they were forcibly educated into a British culture that was not their own. They were converted into being English-speaking subjects of this new developing nation. However, it's important to note that this compulsory form of education was, and this is not unique in the history of the world, of course, this has happened many times, but this kind of compulsory education was not intended to produce citizens on the same order as those who constructed the compulsory education. It was intended to create subjects of the imperial project. In other words, you weren't being educated to become a British citizen. You were being educated to become a subject of the United Kingdom. Does that distinction make sense? Okay. And furthermore, you weren't simply being, if you were First Nations and you were forcibly stripped of your language and your culture and taught English as well as British culture, you were being not only taught to be a subject, but you were actually being taught, in many cases, to be a laborer, to be a worker. And you were being taught actually skills that we would still recognize as skills. So you were being taught fairly high-end craft, for instance, skills, like carpentry, woodworking, but not minor craft skills, but actually very high-end craft skills. So there was, at this time, because that was necessary, so at this time there was this creation of a very highly skilled labor force, but it was also a labor force that was intended to stay in this register, to stay in this space, as a working class, as a class of people who were workers, who would support the development of this nation state. And again, that's not unique, of course, in the history of the world. That's happened many times. But it's interesting to think about, too, that this is the intentional creation of a working class through compulsory education, and that that was, in fact, the purpose of compulsory education. Not to inform you of what your choices were or to make you a better citizen, but to make you a worker so that you could work to support the development of the nation state. Okay, of course, this is a different category than those peoples who were brought to the United States, what became the United States, in the slave trade, and the people that were brought here, African Americans, now we would refer to these people, but they were at that time, they're Africans. They're just from Africa and uprooted from their homes in Africa and brought here as part of the slave trade. So, but and that involves no education. That is not about becoming a better laborer in the skilled sense. That's just about being a working force. So when we think about this, the kind of structured creation of these different classes, it's curious because this is in the service of what we now imagine to be a classless society, or a society that is not supposed to have those rigid structures. That's a kind of strange contradiction. And there are a lot of these contradictions. Another one of these contradictions is that the quote-unquote pioneering spirit of American individualism was, in some cases, a reality. If you were European, let's say that you were from Germany, and you were an immigrant, and you came to the United States, and you pushed out along this imaginary line of the frontier, and you went to some place like, let's say, Kansas. This was an incredibly rough landscape. So you also being from Central or Western Europe, you were probably totally unprepared for how incredibly difficult life in the American Midwest or the West would be. It was extreme in its, the demands of the landscape were extreme. So it in fact did require people to have this sense of rugged individualism, this sense of being strong, independent, self-sufficient. It was in fact necessary. And independence was necessary in pushing out along this imaginary frontier because you would not have much to rely on in terms of other people. So in American culture, I, for instance, love cowboy movies. I love cowboy movies. Okay? I love baseball and apple pie and cowboy movies. These are my credentials. So, but cowboy movies are a perfect example of sort of all of these contradictions. Because on the one hand, the image of the cowboy is an imaginary image. On the other hand, it's very true. If you were one of these Europeans, white Europeans usually, it would require incredible levels of strength and independence and self-determination in order to survive on your own. And you would probably live in small communities, and these small communities were knit together. And I'll talk about that in a little bit later. So then we come to another phrase, which is also related to cowboys, which is to lift yourself up by your bootstraps. Does anybody know this one?
No.
So I'm wearing boots right now, actually. And bootstraps are a part of the leather that goes around the boot. So this idea, lift yourself up by your bootstraps, it's impossible. You cannot do this. It's like physically impossible. You know, like these are the bootstraps right here, you know, like this. And, you know, like this over here, like that. You can't, like, lift yourself. Can't do it. Right? So you can't do that. Here's another one of those cases where, but we believe this somehow, Americans. We somehow believe that this is possible. You can do this.
You cannot do it, but you have to do it like that?
Yes.
Or it means something else.
Yeah.
Means to take care of yourself or provide for yourself.
Oh.
Yes.
Don't expect others to help you out then.
Precisely, yeah.
Right.
It means, so what Mark just said is that it means something else. It's not something literal, but something metaphorical. The metaphor means you have to take care of yourself, and you have to provide for yourself, and you can't expect other people to help you.
Wow.
This is a very basic American idea.
And so silly.
Yes.
Why is it so clear?
Well, it's good if you can do it. A lot of people can't do that.
It's almost...
A lot of people need to work with other people.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, as Mark said, it's rare to be able to even metaphorically do this. It's impossible to do it literally. And it's for the most part, not what anyone does. Everyone works with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone needs other people's help in order to achieve anything.
I think they use this because they know it's impossible, but they still want to do it, so they use this kind of image to show that, well, it's actually possible.
Right. But we do believe it. I can tell you as an American. Yes. And in fact, Mark may be able to also talk, but even to kind of go even further, but as a classical, like again, the cowboy is a kind of classical image, and the cowboy is male. The cowboy is a man, and an American man. And to be an American man, you also have to do this. To take care of yourself. And that will allow you to take care of other people. Your family, maybe, if you have one. But first you have to be able to lift yourself up by your bootstraps. So I mean, in that way, I'm critical about it, but it's still part of what I think I should even be able to do.
The thing is, it bothers a lot of Americans.
Really?
Yeah. Another expression is the strong silent type.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, do you have like that in China, something like that in China?
What does that mean?
The strong silent type?
That's more romantic.
Very romantic, yeah. It's this idea of the cowboy. He's, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's strong, he's quiet, he's alone. Yeah. 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 Clint Eastwood.
John Wayne.
John Wayne. Yeah. Those guys. But not Clint Eastwood as he is now, Clint Eastwood as he was in the 60s and 70s,
right.
Not as he is today.
Somebody
yes.
A man with no name.
Yes. Yes. Okay, so this is one of our, this is really, for American culture, I believe that this is very important for people to understand, that this is a these are guiding principles that actually we're constantly thinking about all the time. Now, along, so there's that. Now, here's a kind of like something almost opposite, but simultaneous, because from the same period of time, the 1800s. In the 1800s, because of the revolution against the British Empire, the British Imperial Colonial Project failed in North America because of this American Revolution. And because of this American Revolution, a certain kind of critique of British culture became part of American culture on a very basic level also. Now, this critique is expressed in multiple ways, but one of the American authors who, because the novel was a dominant form of media at the time in the 1800s, like television or the movies or video games, today the novel was that in the 1800s. So one author of this period is Horatio Alger. Anyone know Horatio Alger?
I know Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Yeah, there's another one. but let's start with Horatio Alger. So Horatio Alger in the 1800s writes a lot of stories, and they're all about boys and men and what it means to be an American boy and an American man. And basically the plot goes like this. A young boy with a humble background somehow succeeds in transforming his life and becoming part of the middle class and achieves security and comfort through hard work, determination, courage, and honesty. Okay.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So this becomes also a basic principle. That this is possible, and that it's not just possible, but that it's part of American culture, because it was not possible in the United Kingdom. It was not possible in Britain for that, what I just described, to have happened. In the United Kingdom, even today, the economic class system is very, very stable and very strict and very rigid. Once born into a certain economic class, it's almost impossible, very rare, that one would change classes, economically speaking. And in the United Kingdom, this kind of economic class is in fact more dominant as a deciding factor about what people think of you than even skin tone or what we call race or ethnicity. So people in the UK, in London, Britain in general, judge each other more by this economic standard than even by race or ethnicity, because that's the kind of priority. And it's very strict and very stable and fixed. So in the 1800s in the United States, as the country was forming, that idea was twisted to the opposite degree, where we believed as a culture that that was wrong and that we were going to be the opposite. So we were going to be the classless society where anyone could come from any position and move ideally up. But that also happens, yes. Yes. So that's known as the phrase rags to riches, to go from rags to riches. And in this Horatio Alger, who was a very popular author in this time period, like 1830s, 1850s, in his version of it, which was again very expressed very clearly, what was also an anxiety that American culture was unfixed, uncertain, was shown as a virtue, that it was open to opportunity. It wasn't So instead of thinking of it negatively in terms of a loss of the British stability, it was turned into a positive. Yes, here we're not stable, but we're also not controlled and fixed by class. We can move upwards. Rags to riches. Through, again, hard work, determination, courage, and honesty. These are like, this is such a perfect expression of what we believe. It's amazing. Because, I mean, part of what's amazing to me about it, and what's funny about it too, is that if it was true at a certain time, which it probably was, and if it's still true, which it probably is to some degree, it's also contrasted by the fact that it's false. We don't actually live in a culture that's where you can do this. And in fact, increasingly, politically, it's increasingly difficult to make those kinds of changes. From what's that?
Like yo-yo.
Like yo-yo? Yeah. Like yo-yo. Well, I mean, not to go too far into this, but basically, I can talk about it if you're interested, but there's basically a moment in America in the 1950s, which is why maybe we're so nostalgic for the 1950s. There's a moment in the 1950s where this is really possible. It's really real. And it's a very short moment. It lasts for about 10 years. And then it goes away. Yeah. And I can talk about why it goes away. But it exists there, and it's possible. But because the actual, just the numbers of the amount of money that it would take to be in one income bracket versus another income bracket, the difference is small in the 1950s. So moving from one to the other is small movements. And now the difference is massive, and it's being made more massive all the time. So it's incredibly much more difficult now to... So, yeah. Okay. I also wanted to say, yes, rags to riches, and then also riches to rags is also another possibility, right? And as much as this is one of those contradictions, as much as we believe that we can achieve this class mobility, which is what's called class mobility, to move from one class to another, as much as we believe that this is possible through hard work, determination, courage, and honesty, okay, we believe that. We also believe that this is possible through blind luck. This is just the lottery. It's just possible. Outrageous fortune. One day, any one of us could be a millionaire in the United States. Some, right? Maybe today. Right? And, yeah, and this is another, it's profound because it really is another guiding principle, that somehow you could go from really the kind of like most desperate levels to the most luxurious levels overnight, with no effort. Yeah.
And you could also achieving riches by doing the opposite of those virtues.
That's true.
Which isn't funny.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
But we do honestly believe that you could go, you become a superstar overnight.
By pure luck. Yeah.
Pure luck.
Yeah.
Or by being discovered. By being chosen.
And that happens.
Yes, and that happens. Yeah. And we love to repeat that it happens.
Yeah.
We do. I mean, I bet we have examples, the tips of our tongue.
They're great stories.
Yes, there are great stories. And we repeat them endlessly. Because we're very attached to this idea that this could happen. And we celebrate the people who win the lottery. We celebrate them. It doesn't matter who they are, what else is going on in their lives. We don't care.
Yeah.
They are true Americans. They deserve as much airtime as the president, you know, because they won the lottery, right? I don't know. It's strange.
But can I say something?
Of course.
But it's so scary because I learned many who won the lottery, they kill them, they kidnap them. So it's not...
Sure, no. It's not always good to win the lottery. No.
It's definitely kind of touchy, yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, these are kind of two very contrasting models of success, but they're really American models of success. So, work hard, just work hard. Okay? We can get behind that one. Work hard. And then the other one, like, famous overnight, success overnight, immediately, magically, somehow. Okay, so these two models of success are also expressions of what's called the American dream, right? So the quote-unquote American dream, now, it's achieved either through these two competing and contradictory models of success, or many other ways. But these two models are some of the most striking in our culture. And one of the problems with the quote-unquote American dream is that it has been defined very restrictively. It's been defined in a very limited kind of way. Also in a way which is very, very consumerist. It's very much about buying, consuming the right products or services, and that consumption is the best achievement within American culture. So that's a real problem also. I'll compare that to the fact that American culture, as you all I'm sure know, is very business oriented. We are entrepreneurial. What is it? Chiesa? 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 Mandarin? Chiesa? 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 Entrepreneurial. So, I would be really curious what chiesa means, translated, besides entrepreneurial. Does it have an...
The same.
Does it have an implication, like...
Make money.
Is it a good thing, a bad thing?
It's just
good thing?
Some business to operate with business.
Uh-huh, okay. And it's smart about business and...
Yeah.
Business-oriented.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Chiesa. So, that sounds pretty positive. Of course, being entrepreneurial as a culture has some very negative possibilities. Here's one example. This goes into a slightly political direction if you interpret it that way. But I lived in Austria, which is right next to Germany, and when I was first living there, I was talking to people very casually about America and the United States, and about very casually about something related to sickness when we have to go to the hospital, and I very casually used the phrase the healthcare industry. And I wasn't being critical. I was just saying, oh, you know, the healthcare industry, it's complicated. You have to have insurance, et cetera, et cetera. And my Austrian friends they just immediately changed. And they got so angry at me. And I couldn't understand why. And we went over the German, Austrian-German, and made sure I was saying it correctly. Yes, I was saying it correctly. There was no misunderstanding about the language, but they were so angry at the principle that healthcare is an industry. And in the United States, this is a fact. healthcare is an industry, like every other industry. And in fact, healthcare is one of the most profitable industries to be involved in. So that's one of the kind of like possible negative side effects of an entrepreneurial culture, is that we have in the United States really transformed transformed many of the aspects of our lives into business projects, which is potentially a problem. I would say even furthermore that this is a problem because it has become increasingly our business orientation has become increasingly corporate, and corporate culture has become increasingly dominant, not just in the United States but globally. And so that's not just an American problem, that's a global problem. But it really, and it's not only because of the United States, but it's certainly United States-based corporations that were given permission to function in this way, either explicitly or implicitly, became global corporations and then started to express this these cultures throughout the world.
Why do you call it as a problem?
Well, now I'm going to editorialize. I'm going to give you an opinion, this is not always the case with every corporation. So it's maybe too much to just say corporate culture. However, a corporation which is a for-profit corporation is focused on profits. Period. And at the end of the day, the people that work at the corporation, from the highest level to the lowest level, are responsible for producing profits. They're not necessarily responsible for producing a better world to live in. Nor are they necessarily responsible for producing better living conditions for even the people that work at the corporation. This is a very simple kind of observation, not very complicated. So, for instance, providing healthcare is evaluated on the basis of profit margins. Is it profitable to give healthcare? And in some cases, this becomes very contentious. Walmart Corporation is one example where it would. Basically, certain corporate decisions which put profit in front of people make it very difficult to even earn a living wage while working multiple jobs. So this is part of the problem, potentially. Yeah. I could name far more. British Petroleum, for instance, BP, is responsible for incredible events of environmental and human devastation for which they have still not taken any responsibility because it's not part of their charter. Right? So corporations, yes, very good at making money, but not necessarily right. And again, that's a little bit political, what I just said, but I'll stand behind that. In other nation states, just as an example, in other nation states, like the one that I have the most experience with is Austria and Germany. In those nation states, for instance, for a corporation to call itself German, it would have to at least attempt to improve the quality of German life. This is just an example. Or for a corporation to call itself Austrian, it would have to support Austrian culture or Austrian environmental concerns, for instance. In the United States, corporations were granted personhood rights and legally, and so have no obligation outside of the same obligations that we as people, individuals, have. So, yeah. Okay. I promised to get a little negative.
Right.
So, Now, just a few other things. Mentioning other countries and mentioning, I want to be explicit about this, mentioning American culture is an immigrant culture. It's a culture based on immigration. Is anyone here born in the United States? Born in the United States? Great. Okay, so there's about three of us. And born here, born physically?
Yeah.
Right, okay, so there's about three of us. So the United States is an immigrant country. It's a country based on immigration. That might be short term. It might be long term. You might become a naturalized U.S. citizen, or you might not. You might come and be here for some time and then return to some other place. That has been part of the idea of American culture, of the United States. That's been part of the idea from the very beginning, is that we, and now this is important, especially for those who identify as culturally Chinese, even if not nationally Chinese, that there's a kind of clarity about ethnicity and culture that's singular, being from a singular place that has a very long history. Whereas in the United States, it's a very short period of time, just over 200 years, and even then, not a singular, there's no such thing as a singular American culture or identity, which is maybe why we're so attached to those imaginations about the singular American identity. The cowboy, for instance, is maybe so romantic because it's like impossible to be so clear about where we're from. So in that sense, we are an immigrant culture, which again has, especially now with the elections going on, there's a political importance to the fact the United States was formed out of immigration and has always relied on immigration as part of its basic culture. And certain political forces will represent this. Other political forces will try to deny this and will try to establish some other idea about America as some singular, solid culture. Or even suggest that we should no longer permit immigration into the country. I'm waiting for when they suggest that we shouldn't support immigration out of the country. I will be very nervous then, but I carry my passport with me, right, like this. It's not a joke. I'm not really making a joke. But because this really is my passport, and as you can tell, it's all, if Ajin were here, she'd be so shocked that I'm showing you this because it's so worn out, and it's worn out because I really have it in my pocket all the time. I just think, you know, when they start to talk about how we shouldn't immigrate out of the country, then it's going to be good for me to have this in my pocket. No. No. So, okay. Because it's an immigrant country, it's also a hybrid culture. It's not a singular culture, which is what I meant in this comparison to cultural Chinese identity, even if it's not a national Chinese identity. That's still some kind of singular reference point. But for us, we shouldn't really have a singular reference point. Because we are this way, we're also inclusive in many cases. And this is a positive aspect of the United States, is that it is, in fact, these things that I've been telling you, even the ones that are fantastical, people tend to believe them. And because they believe them, that opens up some possibility. So people do believe that you can go from one class to another. And even if it's very difficult, the fact that people believe it makes it more possible, I think, I would argue. Also, people believe in change. Famously, the last presidential election was based entirely on the principle of change. Remember that? So that was all about change. Now, whether or not change actually occurred is a different question. But it was about change. It was a campaign about change. And change was a goal and an ideal in that campaign, because it is actually an American cultural goal and an American cultural ideal. We do believe in change, in principle. We actually insist upon it politically. And again, this is part of the formation of the United States in response to and critical of the British imperial project, was to insist on a level of change that would be regular, that would not be solid and fixed the way that the monarchy was solid and fixed. So this idea of change, at least, if not actual change, is built into our culture also at a very basic level.
I have a little bit of thought, like maybe it's kind of negative or even kind of controversial kind of thought. But I think this kind of idea that people believe in this kind of American dream, things could change, past could change, actually makes the society stable. Because like if people don't even believe that it's true, like people won't work hard or not, like obey the authorities and things like that, and it would actually, on the other hand,
destabilize
the society.
Yeah.
So I think this is, well, maybe in some sense, government actually wants people to believe that they could work hard and grow upward, but they don't. A lot of people up there, maybe they don't even want it actually happen.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. And again, this is something that I could talk a little bit more about if you're interested, but I tend to agree with you. And I tend to also think that the Hollywood system is the perfect expression of how what you're describing has been enacted in our media and has been made real by the media, so that people have a very clear imagination about the world that they live in. So, but the American dream is definitely related to American culture, since it is a kind of aspiration, a kind of goal. I will say, however, on the positive side, that change let me be careful about this. The change occurs regularly in American culture, and that it happens on different scales. So it happens on a small scale. We do believe, we believe very heavily and strongly in personal transformation. We believe very much culturally that people can change. And so there's a kind of like allowance for that in our culture, which does allow for some flexibility, let's say.
Can I
Yes.
They want to change the president. Okay. So the president from before that, she have a lot of projects. So if this is a project, it's not over yet because 4 years already finished. But he started. It's not easy.
Yeah. Right.
It's not easy. Instead of helping one another,
sure,
so that they will do the good job.
Sure.
But if they get jealous, so they are looking for mistake of the president instead of helping him. So if the new president will come again, another start new project.
Sure.
So how can we
Obama always gets a bad
Every promise, promise. But I want to be a president, so
Right. I mean, we have an idea that at the end of a president's term, there's somehow like a switch that's just thrown, like off and on, like end, you know, start a new one. But of course, that's never the actual case. Presidencies put in place projects which last way beyond the end of their terms, and they do that on purpose, also to continue to have an effect on the political, right. Yes, absolutely, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Right. Time?
What? We have something
So, I guess that's about it for today, right? In terms of time? But if this raises, I would love to hear what you have to say or think about that. Especially, I have some ideas about, like I said, for instance, Chinese culture, if even not national, but cultural connection to a singular identity, something that is Chinese, that is very has duration, versus American, very young and confused. I have an idea about that, but I would love to hear if you also think that, what you think about that, and if you think that that's, if you feel connected to something that's sort of singular and identifiable, or if you think these observations that I've been sharing with you about Americans are founded, or... Okay.
You talk about changes.
Yes.
Do they have a direction of the changes or the value of change?
If I understand correctly, you mean that sometimes we're attached to change in principle. Absolutely. 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 Very American. Really, really, absolutely. And the faster the better. Right? Yes. And I mean, that speaks to something about impatience, and in, which is a negative term, but some expectation that instant response, instant changes. Yeah. I think that we, I know for a fact that we have a cultural belief about the dichotomy between Eastern culture, Western culture, and that what you're expressing is one of those dichotomies, that Western culture, European and American, and especially this is related to industrialization, this is especially related to not just business but technology, is that in the United States in particular, breaking everything into small component parts was really developed beyond any level of prior success during the Industrial Revolution in the United States. So Ford, the automotive industry, Taylor, the factory, the automation of factory life, is about breaking everything into small pieces and putting those small pieces back together again, and very focused knowledge that's very specific. And that has had a profound impact also on our culture. And as you said, it's a value to know about something very specifically, but not necessarily know about any of the connections outside of that. Whereas we do have a belief, and I don't know how grounded it is, but what you're saying makes me suspect that it is grounded, that Eastern cultures more generally, or Asian cultures, would place a more of a value on more of a connected perspective. I'm aware that this has all, like, other cultural histories. Right. And that they value very specific knowledge. Is that what you... Right. Balance though.
Yeah, it's true.
Corporate culture, for instance, has embraced ideas of certain kinds of ideas of collaboration and quote unquote synergy, right? People coming together and things happening. So corporate culture has embraced certain ideas about working together, but you know, maybe they're only through the lens, maybe if not profit, then at least like getting sort of business at hand done. They're not necessarily philosophic ideas, right? They're not like philosophically interested in connecting parts. Yeah, I think when you're working with your colleagues in the United States, representing an individual, representing yourself individually is extremely important. Extremely important. Representing yourself as an individual who makes individualist kinds of choices, extremely important. You know, hanging back and thinking about the group, not usually going to benefit you. Sure. Oh, yeah.
So to American is very nice to you. Does it mean that he wants to see a bench?
Yes.
If an American is being nice to you, does it mean he wants to take advantage of you? Is your question? Mark says yes.
Yeah, a certain amount of time.
Yeah. So we shouldn't make friends with Americans.
No.
Only certain ones.
Yeah. Right.
I would add to that that last week I introduced this topic a little bit and started to talk about it last week. And I was talking last week about enthusiasm, an American enthusiasm, an American positivity, which is those are very strong cultural values. So I wouldn't be afraid that every American who's nice to you, but because we have a tendency to be overly enthusiastic, and we have a tendency to be overly positive. So they might not necessarily want something from you.
get to know them a little bit.
Yeah.
Give them
that's good advice.
Yeah. Yeah, get to know them.
Dory?
I like the one you say that work hard and honesty and all that.
Determination, yeah.
Courage and determination.
Yeah. I like that. That's like biblical.
Yeah.
Because it is you work hard, that is your own plan, and it's a lot of love.
Yeah.
But you say that winning in the lottery is still not lotto, because that's not your own plan.
Yeah.
So I like the hard worker, and honesty, and I love that.
Sometimes when America claims to be a Christian nation, to be bound on Christian principles, it does seem to seem that way. Like with Dory just said about those virtues.
Okay.
I think for a couple of years come to the United States and here the idea of business seems not only in the society, but also equally in the church.
Yeah.
At the beginning I said, you that go to church, they said, this thing God business. And I cannot serve that kind of concept.
Yeah.
Because business is for the profit. But for church business, non profit.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
but this is a very special church, and I'm very happy to be able to have this conversation. Cause it's great. Yeah.
Well, I think it's a good time. I still have one more time next week. One more.
One more.
One more.